This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. With all the things Congress and the President have on their plate, you would think they wouldn't have time for games. But evidently they do. They are getting very good at a game called Kick the Can. In fact, if there was a World Series of Kick the Can, Washington would definitely walk away with the championship. Rather than the recent government shutdown solving the debt ceiling crisis, it simply delayed it. Or resulted in a delay in the decision on whether or not to raise the amount of money the government can now borrow. Congress will take that up again early next year, and a government shutdown may happen all over again. Well, there are differing opinions on the impact of this recent impasse. Some say our trip to the brink of disaster and the lowered approval ratings for Democrats, and particularly Republicans, might have chastened politicians and improved the chances of agreement on future legislation. Others believe the recent crisis simply amped up the bitter animosity between parties. So we've asked our own experts to help us analyze the fallout and predict where we might go from here. Dr. Eric Heberlig is professor of political science at UNC Charlotte. He once served as a congressional fellow and is a co-author of Classics in Congressional Politics. Welcome back to the show.
Morning, Mike.
Dr. Michael Bitzer is associate professor of politics and history and acting provost at Catawba College, as well as WFAE's Party Line blogger. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And they're both in our Spirit Square studio. We're joined by phone by Dr. Scott Huffman, professor of political science and director of the Social and Behavioral Research Lab at Winthrop University, where he sits this morning crunching numbers. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome. What was the immediate impact of the government shutdown and holding the debt ceiling decision hostage over the Affordable Care Act to the parties involved? I don't know who to ask that question of. You're all qualified. You want to talk, so go ahead, Dr. Bitzer. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think everybody in D.C. got slammed. It's just gradations of who hates who more. It is... Both parties, their approval ratings are in the tank. If you look at any kind of public poll, Pew, Gallup, ABC News, I mean, Congress's levels of approval is just, you know, getting into only their mothers are approving of them, and even them, and even they are bailing on their members of Congress. So it's pretty grim. The Republicans took, I think, the biggest hit, particularly Tea Party aligned Republicans, but nobody came out of this, you know, in good fashion.
Scott Huffman, you literally are sitting there this morning crunching numbers because you run a polling organization within the college. I mean, these are the people who are giving Congress low grades in polls as a result of this government shutdown are the same people who sent these people to Washington, are they not?
In general, they are. But remember, a lot of these polls we're looking at are general population polls, and the general population is absolutely disgusted by this. But the people who show up and vote are a slightly different creature. They are a subset of those folks. And the people who show up and vote are more likely to be stronger partisans. And those stronger partisans are very, very angry at the other guy. They feel very strongly that this was a debacle, it was an embarrassment, but it's mostly the other guy's fault. And a lot of them did send these people to Congress. And so what you'll see is in statewide polls, overall, everybody's down, and including individual members of Congress, but within their districts because of gerrymandering, but not even huge gerrymandering. This has been my point for a long time. Because of just slight gerrymandering, they have enough approval to stay in office. And so while overall everybody's approval is down, as long as you keep the subpart of your base that's most important to you happy, you're still probably going to get to keep your job. So we are faced with this thing where that's absolutely right. Everybody is disliked and despised because of the debacle we've just seen. But as long as you've kind of salved the wounds of your core constituency, again, over 90% of these people who go up for reelection will be reelected.
So, Dr. Heberlig, that kind of takes the steam out of my next question, which was, will all this be forgotten by election time, and will this have any lasting effect? I mean, if the vote were held today, what I'm hearing Scott Huffman say is it wouldn't make any difference. The polls are low, but they'd still be voted back into office.
Yeah, well, we'll have to see. Going through this again in a couple months may reinforce people's negative attitudes towards Congress. I think the dynamic that it plays into now is it affects each party's ability to recruit candidates to run against people in the other party. It affects perhaps donors' calculations. So those factors matter now more than where voters are.
The GOP is the party of business, and this has hurt business. And there's some question about whether or not the Christmas shopping season will be as robust as perhaps it might have been, given what just happened and the uncertainty about what will happen after the first of the year. How has business reacted to this? What is business saying to the GOP?
I think that's a key component, and probably plays into the dynamic of what happens in January and February when we do this again, that business is putting heavy pressure on the Republicans not to go through this again. So we'll see whether the kind of the establishment Republican faction steps up in January and February and says, look, we need to strike a deal with the Democrats, because it seems to me unlikely that the Tea Party faction is going to cave it. They're going to see this as a good strategy and try it again. So it's up to the McCain wing of the Republican Party to try to head it off beforehand.
And if you look,
Mike, can I add something?
Sure.
Let me follow up on something I said before. 90% of the people who run for re-election will still probably get elected. But I think the important point that I guess I glossed over, the most important seats are going to be those open seats. Those are going to be much more contested, and that's where Democrats will have an edge. If it's going to swing, it's going to happen with open, uncontested seats. And the Rothberg report has, after the government shutdown, put a lot more of those seats in the swing column that used to be in the moderately safe column.
And there's going to be one in Florida. There's a special election coming up with the death of Bill Young last week.
Mm-hmm.
That district went 50-49 in the presidential election. So that is a kind of classic swing district. That one, I think, is going to be where all, a kind of canary in the coal mine sense of how the public is reacting to this. Longtime Republican held that seat. Was an incumbent. Incumbents have a tremendous power to hold on to their seats. Once it's thrown open, it's anybody's guess.
So I'm getting mixed signals here because of a comment that Scott Huffman, you made a few minutes ago about relatively safe districts, and then 30 seconds ago about things being in flux. And we did a whole show on gerrymandering.
Right. Not all seats are equal.
I went away from the show on gerrymandering thinking that, well, we're kind of in this situation that we can't get out of. You can't vote the bums out because they're all gerrymandered into safe districts. And what you're saying is that's not necessarily true.
Well, there are some districts. There's a handful of districts that are kind of the classic swing districts. Stu Rothenberg, Charlie Cook has probably identified about 15 that could be completely tossed up districts. One thing that I would also be looking for is potentially in the primary elections. If some of these incumbents are challenging their bases or not adhering to what Scott talked about, the core constituency within these districts, you may see some challenges within primaries that normally we talk about the general election, but that could be the bigger issue for some of these.
And the other place I think to look for the political effects is not necessarily in the House races, because as we've discussed, they're pretty safe, but in the Senate races and governor's races where you can't gerrymander them, their state. So we have a governor's election in Virginia coming up in 2 weeks, where the dynamics of the shutdown have reinforced the lead of the Democratic candidate. So again, a Democratic win there will play into the talking points of the establishment Republicans that we can't afford to do this again.
But so what? I mean, if it is the House where the problem lies, where we have a minority who's very vocal and very intransigent and won't compromise because they see compromise as a dirty word, and they are kind of safe where everything else is in flux, the Senate, the president, the governor's races, et cetera, what difference does it make?
Because it changes the dynamic within the caucus, that right now you have Speaker Boehner who won't bring anything to the floor unless it has basically the support of all the Republicans. Now he and perhaps the other establishment wing of the party can say, look, if the Tea Party wing won't cooperate on anything, we can't afford to do this again. We need to reach some deals where we can at least protect ourselves, even if that means having to rely on a few Democratic votes. I don't think they do that often, but in situations like government shutdowns, debt deals, they're willing to throw the Tea Party overboard.
Scott
Well, Eric's absolutely right. The first thing I think we have to look at is what happens with the Republican leadership, whether or not a minority group, you know, 80 or fewer Republicans out of the House can take kind of control of the direction of the ship is going to depend directly on what happens with the leadership in the House after this and what changes they make. But also remember, it is the statements that most districts are gerrymandered, but some are still competitive, are not in conflict. I mean, there are certainly states like California that have passed laws that have reduced the amount of gerrymandering. In some areas, you can gerrymander all you want. It just happens to be a geographic area where it's still a toss-up. So just because you have a lot of safe seats doesn't mean there aren't still a lot of geographic toss-ups. And when you have toss-ups plus open seats after a time of great turmoil, then even though, you know, 90% of the people who choose to run for elected may get in, you can still have a swing. Look, when Newt Gingrich and the Republicans took over during the Clinton era, over 90% of the people who ran for re-election did get reelected in the House. It was the open seats that swing. So those statements aren't really in conflict. But I think the key things are what Eric said. What happens with the leadership is the leadership able to now control this voice a little more. Also, by the time we get to the election, both are right. Look, this is a swing district in Florida. It's an open race. It's a canary in the coal mine. The Virginia race is a canary in the coal mine, and both are going to absolutely change their fundraising strategies, the basis of whatever happens there, which is something that Eric alluded to earlier.
So given what you just said, Dr. Heberlig, about I forgot exactly what you just said, but it's germane to the question. And the question is, some experts are saying that one of the good things that could come out of these low poll numbers for Congress, particularly for Republicans, is a chastened Congress and one that is going to be more willing to find points of compromise going forward. You think that's going to be the case? Is that a good thing?
Somewhat more. There is an incentive for them to say, look, our brand stinks. We need to change our brand. We need to have some accomplishments that we can take back to voters. But the fundamental issue is that the Republicans in the House, the Democrats in the Senate, and the president don't agree on very much. So it's really threading a needle for them to come up with significant accomplishments that would really impress voters.
Tea Party is loud.
They
are passionate.
Yes.
They have very strongly held convictions, which they're not afraid to act on,
right.
All of which are admirable.
Sure.
But they are a minority, and they are a minority in the Congress, and they're a minority within the House. Why did John Boehner then feel so the need to be so closely letting the tail wag the dog, essentially?
I think part of it is the fact that these are energized, these are mobilized, these are very vocal individuals. If you look within the caucus, there's probably anywhere from 60 to potentially 80 members who would align themselves or kind of float into that Tea Party caucus. The concern, though, is that they could rile up and feel very passionately to where they could go out and talk about primary challenges to some of the more moderates. And I think if you looked at what Ted Cruz said this weekend, they're not going anywhere, and they feel very firm in their convictions.
That's Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College. Also with us, Dr. Eric Heberlig from UNC Charlotte and Dr. Scott Huffman from Winthrop University. We will continue this little conversation when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and WBTV News 3. Mornings and evenings, the First Alert weather team forecast weather for the region. WBTV First Alert mobile weather app brings interactive radar and up-to-date forecast. WBTV on your side.
And the Beckler Museum of Modern Art presenting Modernism in Changing Times. Works from 1968, a chronological look at the museum's permanent collection, exploring abstraction, geometry, and more. Details at Beckler.org. World's Fairs, speaking of museums, World's Fairs were considered the most important vehicles for debuting advancements in modern living. Things like ceramics first came to people's attention. At a World's Fair, precious metalwork, even television and ice cream were debuted at World's Fairs, and now you have an opportunity to look back on some of the objects that our ancestors marveled at during fairs between 1851 and 1939. They're part of a Mint Museum exhibition, and we take a peek tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Saudi Arabia is warning its decades-old alliance with the U.S. is strained. At the same time, they face increasing pressure at home over women's rights, challenges for Saudi Arabia domestically and abroad.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE, and we're talking today with three political scientists about the fallout from the Washington government shutdown and what may be coming down the road next in February when we go through all of this again with Dr. Michael Bitzer, Dr. Eric Heberlig, and Dr. Scott Huffman. We already have a couple people on the phone, although I haven't given out the phone number, but let's bring a couple of these folks into the conversation. Scott in Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. I get a little confused because my name is Scott Huffman, and you know you're talking to Dr. Scott Huffman. So
is your name really Scott Huffman?
Yes, it is.
How do you spell the last name?
Huffman.
I'm sorry.
Well, anyway, I just wanted to get hit on the aspect of gerrymandering. I live in the university area, and my district used to be it's now Richard Hudson, and they moved me into Mel Watts' district, but. They gerrymandered that area, and that's an example right there. I believe that Richard Hudson feels safe in his district that he'll get reelected. And, you know, he voted. I get his newsletters all the time because I was on the former representative's list, and so I see what he's saying about how he's trying to defend freedom. And I just don't agree with this tactic. This shutdown also cost us $21 billion in just the cost to our debt, and you know that's passed on to taxpayers. So where's the Tea Party outcry there? So, but you know, I'm just curious about the gerrymandering and how it affects North Carolina because it also affects Pittenger's district and McHenry's district. They also moved those lines as well to solidify those seats in the House. Also,
well, Scott Huffman, you're going to get an answer from Michael Bitzer.
Oh, okay.
Just how it is.
You're welcome.
If you look at all the North Carolina congressional districts in 2012, there is a very close relationship between the vote that the presidential candidates got and the vote that the congressional candidates got for each party. So you take the 8th congressional district. Barack Obama got 45% of the vote in that district. The Democratic candidate got 42%. If you look in Mel Watts' district, Barack Obama got 79%. Mel Watt got 79%. So there is a kind of relationship going on that we can look at these districts. And when seats do open up, if we look at the presidential voting in that particular district, we can get a pretty good sense of who might be favored one way or the other.
Okay. Scott, thank you for your call. Let me go to John in Charlotte. Welcome, John.
Thank you. I wonder if Professor Bitzer would comment on the fact that there is currently litigation over the North Carolina redistricting that is in the North Carolina Supreme Court currently, and my guess is, depending if the decision is not in favor of those challenging the current districts, that it'll go to the U.S. Supreme Court. So the question is, are you keeping an eye on that litigation, because if it is complete by 2014 and is successful, that's going to create a new landscape.
Oh, sure. I mean, it's not a redistricting year if we don't have a Supreme Court case going up to the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, it just has happened since the 1990s. The big question in my mind is the Republicans were very careful in terms of defining how they redistricted based on partisanship. Now, there's a relationship between political affiliation and race, and we can't discount that. But the issue of things like splitting precincts and other issues may be something that could be grounded. But right now, I'm hard pressed to see how the challenges go forward and are successful.
John, thank you for your call. Let me go to an email, one more on primaries before we move on to other things. Chris emails, wouldn't open primaries help? I'd love one ballot for the primaries where I could vote for candidates from all parties, just like the general election. What's the point of being an independent if you have to choose one party's ballot in the primary election?
Other states that have open primaries, there really isn't a huge difference, in part because many independents don't participate in party primaries. One innovation I think is interesting is what California did for the first time this past election, which was have what's called a jungle primary that I think is speaking to what Chris is asking for, which is having all candidates from the office in the same primary, and then the top two vote-getters go under the general election. So you have the possibility of, in a safe Democratic district, two Democrats to choose from, or in a safe Republican district, two Republicans to choose from. So that gives people from the other party the ability to select the more moderate candidate from the dominant party in that race, rather than most districts currently where you have a safe incumbent who might be ideologically extreme against a nobody from the other party, and it's a wipeout.
So what would have to happen for that to happen in any state, particularly in North Carolina, and what are the chances of that kind of primary being inaugurated?
The state legislature would have to approve it in North Carolina, which means there is zero chance.
In some states, it would require a constitutional change, a lot of them legislative change. And most parties do not want this. It weakens the strength of the party. So the parties would lobby their support in the legislature to say, don't let this happen. A blanket-style primary has been in use in various forms in Louisiana, too. It's always great to see two people of the same party squaring off against each other in the general election, because it makes the fights interesting to watch. But I don't think it makes it a whole lot of fun to participate in.
James in Mooresville, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, does anybody think it's odd, or is it just me, that the Tea Party wants governments to get out of corporations, and like the Occupy movement wants corporations to get out of government, but yet they're opposed to each other? Is that odd, or is it just me?
That's funny. Who wants to take that?
Oh. Well, they're kind of libertarians from other angles. I think one of the dynamic that's going on in the Tea Party is that you have a very libertarian strand of them, but they're aligning with traditional Christian conservatives. So you have the Tea Party that's kind of on two different areas in terms of their priorities. What unites them is their distrust for the federal government and taxes in particular. But that's a critical dynamic as this plays out.
Well, explain this to me with regard to the Affordable Care Act, because one of the problems with the Affordable Care Act is the government website, the federal government website. In states that have built their own exchanges, North Carolina is not one, there's less of a problem because the states are running those websites. Why wouldn't they have wanted – why wouldn't Republicans – because it's only Republican-controlled states that don't have these state-based exchanges. Why wouldn't the Republicans in those states want to have control over the Health Care Act?
Because they want to have nothing to do with Obamacare whatsoever.
But they don't trust the federal government. That's where the problem is going.
It's more of a symbolic issue than policy implementation issue.
All right. James, thank you for your call. The government is set up – our founding fathers set the government up so that we could avoid the tyranny of the majority. But in order for minorities to be heard and to get what they want, they have to be willing to compromise. And the majority has to be willing to compromise. And yet the Tea Party in the minority seems to be dead set on compromise. Do they have any chance of achieving their goals if they won't compromise on anything?
Well, if you define their goal as blocking things,
then they're achieving their goal.
Yeah. I mean, they want to stop the expansion of government.
Okay. What else do they want?
Cuts in taxes, which comes from smaller government, and that's pretty well less regulation. Okay. So the more they can stop, I mean, that's pretty much their objective.
But if they want those things, they're not really getting those things. They've shut the government down. They've been obstructionist on lots of pieces of legislation, but they haven't gotten what they wanted directly, and which they could maybe get little pieces of if they compromised, couldn't they?
But they believe that if they only had more of their kind in Congress, that they could truly achieve everything. I mean, if you listen to people like Eric Erickson, the Red State blogger, Ted Cruz, you know, others, they came out of this fight thinking, hey, we got the holding on sequestration, the budget issue. We just need more of our own kind in Congress, and we can achieve everything that they want. Yeah, some would describe that as delusional, but that's their thinking.
This is very important. You have got to remember, and this is something that both Eric and Michael pointed out, they see themselves as in the right. And when you are in the right, when you have holy might on your side, you can't compromise. I mean, you have to remember that they view their principles and ideologies as sacrosanct as some that other people have had. I'm going to catch flack for this comparison, but if you read Dr. King's letter from the Birmingham jail, he says to the eight ministers who wrote to him, you know, this is not an issue that we can compromise and wait on because it's simply morally right. Well, the folks in the Tea Party believe the exact same thing about their ideals. Now, your listeners may not agree with them that it's a that they're even correct, much less that it's a holy fight, but they do. You know, you talked about our founder, Samuel Adams, said it does not take a majority to prevail, but rather an irate, tireless minority keen on setting brush fires of freedom in the minds of men. Those are the kind of quotes and ideas when you believe you have a holy fight on your hands that you'll take to the forefront and refuse to compromise. Intransigence is a virtue when that is your viewpoint.
To continue the religious analogy, the Tea Party types have this apocalyptic worldview that unless we stop this disaster from occurring, you know, all bets are off. The analysis they keep speaking about as well, if we don't stop the debt or these deficits, we're going to end up like Greece. Well, most economists would, you know, quibble with that. But that's how they see it.
And they based it on what?
Ideology mostly, but, you know, we do have a very large debt. We have been running very large deficits. You could argue that there are good economic reasons for that in the context of the recession.
Some of the Tea Party people said that if we had gone into default, it wouldn't have been a big deal. And every economist in the world, just about, and every business leader in the world said it would have been a catastrophe. It would have ruined the world economy. I mean, is this another instance of facts be damned?
Well, it's ideology overriding expertise. And, you know, the right wing of the Republican Party has distrusted academics at least since Richard Nixon. So they're not going to put a whole lot of stock in what experts say because experts are part of the establishment, which is part of the problem.
Well, let's get back to the task at hand here, the problem at hand, and that is the debt ceiling and the closing of the government. In 2011, there was a so-called super budget committee composed of Democrats and Republicans in Congress, 12 people charged with finding an additional $1.5 trillion in debt savings over a 10-year period. Four of those members of that super budget committee also served on the Simpson-Bowles Deficit Reduction Panel and voted against the plan. So what impact, if any, did this older super budget committee have on either our spending or on debt ceiling discussions prior to this one?
I think the biggest thing that came out of it was the threat of sequestration, which basically played itself out. They were to come up with a proposal that if they didn't, this huge sword of sequestration would be hanging over their heads and they would force them to basically get the job done. They didn't get the job done. Sequestration hit. And, you know, we're still operating at those reduced funding levels. So, you know, they talked about another grand bargain. They've talked about another great super committee to get all this pulled together. I can't see realistically them pulling something together in the next 2 months that really addresses anything fundamental unless everybody comes in and says, we just got so hammered in the past 3 weeks, we have got to put aside and be statesmen and do it for the good of the country and for the good of our own party. Or, you know, we're just going to be going through this whole cycle again.
Well, there is a new super budget committee, is there not? Charged with coming up with a deal in December. Who are the members of this committee and how would you handicap the odds that they'll be able to come up with something that avoids another government shutdown and has an impact of some sort on the debt ceiling?
I mean, Patty Murray and Paul Ryan are the two budget chairs in the Senate.
Can you find two more diametrically opposed people?
But I think both – true. But I think both of them would be coming to this saying we've got to do something. The condition that I put on it is can they convince their own colleagues? Can Patty Murray go back to the Democratic Senate caucus and say, look, we're going to have to probably take these cuts in sequestration and that's going to be the new baseline? Can Paul Ryan go back to his caucus and convince them that, look, these are, you know, Obamacare is not going to get defunded. You're just going to have to get over that. But realistically, I'm not convinced that the two bigger groups that have to make these decisions are going to be willing to make those hard choices.
Yeah, I wouldn't look for a grand bargain out of this committee. I think the best to look for is some small compromises that kind of move in the direction of serious deficit reduction. I think the other dynamic that's key to think about for this January deadline is that the type of sequestration cuts that are hitting are heavily weighted towards defense, which is different than the first rounds, which have been heavily weighted to domestic programs. So that's going to hit the Republicans harder. John McCain and Lindsey Graham have spoken out against it. So that, again, may give more weight to the establishment wing to say we need some type of deal in order to avoid these defense cuts. It also creates a risk that Democrats say, well, the Republicans took a pounding on the last government shutdown. The cuts are mostly on things that they like this time, so we have less incentive to bargain.
Yeah. We focused most of our attention on the Congress. I'd like to talk just for a second or two here about the role the president has played in all of this. When Barack Obama was a senator from Illinois, he characterized raising the debt ceiling as a failure of leadership. And yet, during his presidency, I think he's raised the debt ceiling, what, 5-6 times? I'm not sure the number, but it's many times. He's also ignored the findings of the Simpson-Bowles Deficit Reduction Plan, a committee that he put together. He just chose to ignore their recommendations. And now, according to some Republicans, he wants to raise the debt ceiling to the point where we will be spending $1 million a minute until after the 2014 elections. So given his previous stand on this, why is this happening?
Well, he still has a ways to go before he raises the debt ceiling as much as, you know, previous Democratic and Republican presidents. I actually think his previous statement as a senator showed a little naivete over what the debt ceiling was, and he definitely flip-flopped once he was in the position of having to deal with it. The deficit's actually been going down the past 2, if not 3 years. The deficit has simply been going down. You just look at the numbers. But to the degree you have any deficit, you're increasing the debt. The debt ceiling is a weird thing. No business operates under one. The debt ceiling is if I went to you, Mike, and I said, I've researched cars, you're a car dealer, I know exactly how much the car I want to buy is, I don't have the money, I'm going to finance it through you, so I know exactly how much I'm going to borrow and how much it'll cost, sell me the car, you sell it to me, I say, okay, thanks. And in a few months, I say, hey, you know, I had this arbitrary limit, and I knew that when I bought your car, it would go over it. But now that I've reached it, I'm going to kind of stop paying you, even though I already have the car. Thanks again for that. Real businesses simply don't buy things they can't afford. They don't have some arbitrary limit, and they do go into debt if they have to get them out of a situation. We, however, are in extended debt in the U.S. government. I think it showed naivete on Obama's part before. I think the flip-flop was only to be expected when you're in the actual position of power and having to do something. But this is going to be a point of leverage. The deficit's been going down, but the debt's not going to be affected until we go from even the tiniest deficit to a surplus.
I have 10 seconds here. And is also part of the deficit the military spending for Afghanistan, or is that off budget still?
I think that's in budget.
Okay.
Yeah, you have to cover it somehow. Yeah.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Eye, Ear, Nose, and Throat Associates, providing complete eye and ENT care for the last 90 years, offering comprehensive care for infants to seniors in eye and ENT, as well as audiology, allergy, and sleep medicine. Details at goodsenses.com. And Nexen Pruitt, hosting a breakfast briefing for construction industry executives, general liability insurance, insured developments, and coverage for defective construction work, November 13th, online at nexenpruitt.com. Saudi Arabia is warning that its decades-old alliance with the U.S. is strained. At the same time, the country faces increasing domestic pressure over women's rights. Diane Rehm and her guests talk about the challenges for Saudi Arabia at home and abroad coming up at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. We're celebrating 15 years with a special interview featuring author Kathy Reichs next Wednesday at 7 p.m. at the McGlowan Theater. That's November the 6th. You can get details about being in attendance there and the reception following at WFAE.org.
Babies seem to get along quite well with high-tech media. Babies are engaged with the screen, but what are parents engaged with?
If you're planning on using interactive media with your child, use it with your child.
That story later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR News source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the budget and the coming decision, kicking the can down the road till February, I think February 15th, with Dr. Michael Bitzer, Associate Professor of Politics and History and Acting Provost at Catawba College, Dr. Scott Huffman, who is a Professor of Political Science and Director of the Social and Behavioral Research Lab at Winthrop University, and Dr. Eric Heberlig, Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte. Now, the sequence of events is now the Super Budget Committee. Love that name. The Super Budget Committee. And then there we'll meet. Then their recommendations will be made public in December, right, which will really help the Christmas shopping season, followed by budget approval, one would hope, in January, and then the addressing of the debt ceiling in February. What are the chances that Congress will approve the budget recommended by this Super Budget Committee?
The Super Duper?
Yeah, the Super Duper Budget Committee.
You know, everybody loves to have holidays. You know, they don't want to worry about work. Members of Congress have, I think, 14 legislative days left in this year's session. It's going to be hard pressed.
So what if they don't approve? What if they don't approve the budget?
I think we'll go to the 11th hour once again. I mean, it's just, and I think people are getting used to it. I mean, we had that in January. We had it in the past 2 months.
Could they kick the can yet again down the road?
Absolutely.
Sure. But the thing is, they've got to figure out when the November general election is, how far do they want that can to go down, and want this reinvigorated again in the summer?
So what does this do to a struggling economy? What does this do to, I mean, we're getting such bad press all over the world, not only because of this, but because we're spying on everybody in known creation, and they're finding out about it. I mean, what does this say about us to the rest of the world? How does this affect economic markets and people's confidence in the United States, our own confidence in ourselves?
It certainly hurts it.
Yeah. I think,
you know, we're still the reserve currency for the world.
But how much longer will they put up with this nonsense?
A long while, because it's the most stable, and you know, we actually own the majority, or a plurality rather, of our own debt. It's not, the Chinese can't foreclose on us, as has been said. They own a huge chunk of our debt, but we own just as much, if not more, and we are their reserve currency. Although the view of American bonds is going to go down, we could struggle there. The other countries in the world, my friends from around the world, they don't understand how a superpower can operate this way, because their governments don't operate this
way.
Do you? And it literally makes no sense.
Do you understand how we can operate this way?
I understand why it operates. There's a difference in understanding how it actually operates.
I think the key to understanding this is that this is a problem that affects the economy in general. It's kind of a vague thing that's out there. But when you actually come to cutting the debt, that means raising someone's taxes. It means cutting someone's programs. And people will react strongly and negatively to that. Politicians know that. They love to run against the debt. They know everybody hates deficits and debts, but they hate doing anything about it even more.
Are all these people children? I mean, seriously, isn't it time for somebody to just say, we need to be adults about this? Look, we have a spending problem. We have a debt problem. We can't continue this. We need to pull our pants up and be big boys and fix this, and it's going to hurt.
And those people have lost over the last several election cycles.
Yeah, your campaign speech is going to get you probably –
zero votes. So I just Jimmy Carter'd myself.
Right.
You Walter Mondale'd yourself.
Yeah. There's no way for that guy to win and stay in office. If you look at them as single-minded seekers of re-election, then they have to appease the constituencies that get them there. Your speech is going to make one group happy, 12 groups unhappy who will then bond together and kick you out of office.
But isn't that what the Tea Party is doing? Aren't they saying we need to be big boys and we need to cut spending and we need to do this right now?
Well, they say that, but then they want to cut somebody else. They don't want their taxes raised. They don't want their programs cut. They're fine with Social Security and Medicare because they get them. It's other people's programs. It's welfare that's the problem. Well, welfare isn't enough to make up. Yeah, it's not enough to make a big dent in the debt we're talking about.
And the other problem, of course, is when you go out on the street and you ask people, because I saw this on television. I think Jay Leno did this. He asked people about Obamacare versus the Affordable Care Act. Everybody was opposed to Obamacare. Everybody was in favor of the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. And then they love Medicare. They love Social Security. Don't touch it. But you know the government needs to cut spending. Nobody wants to cut anything, and it's untenable. And yeah. Nobody wants to raise taxes either.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, there it is in a nutshell.
Aren't our taxes the lowest they've been since 1961?
Oh, but they're still too darn high, Mike.
Okay. What role will the president be playing in all of these discussions going through the holidays and into February? Will he be meeting with the Budget Committee? Because some of his critics say that he never met with them. He wouldn't meet with them. He stayed aloof and stayed disconnected from the previous discussions. I don't know if that's true or not, but will he be doing more this time?
That will be interesting to watch because I think in January, you know, he and the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, had the deal. And then the Senate came in and said, we got a better deal. And Obama switched and it ticked off the Speaker. And then, you know, the President got ticked off when the Speaker wouldn't return his phone calls. I think with this most recent one, it sounded like Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid on the Democratic side said to the President, stay out of this. We're going to get this taken care of. We're going to do it ourselves. It'll be interesting to see how this negotiation between the executive branch and the legislative branch happens over the next couple of weeks.
If the results are different this time, if we actually reach an agreement on the debt ceiling and we don't close the government down, will that be because of disgust in Congress among the electorate? Will it be because they really feel they can't go down this road again?
I think it'll be because of fear, absolutely. You know, the Democrats don't want to do it, and the mainstream Republicans are afraid of the consequences because they're not certain that they're safe. But they are indeed afraid of a challenge further from the right in a primary. But if we can go past the time when a credible primary challenge could arise against them in 2014, then I think they're going to be willing to move in a way that gets a deal done because they'd be afraid of the general election consequences if they failed to do so.
The last poll numbers I saw, and I'm not sure who the polling organization was or how current this is, but the last numbers I saw showed that Congress had a 13% approval rating and an 81% disapproval rating among the American people. Are those numbers the lowest ever, or have we been here before?
They've been that low for about a year. I found the poll last spring that I used in my Congress class that found Congress was less popular than Hugo Chavez and Vladimir Putin, which really illustrated the point to my class about Congress's unpopularity.
The GOP has long positioned itself as the party of fiscal responsibility, and given the uncertainty they injected into the world economy and our own economy by having some of their members say that a default would be a good thing, can that still be said of the Republican Party, that they are the party of fiscal responsibility?
Well, I think it's which part of the Republican Party you're talking about. You're quoting some of the Tea Party people.
It's a two-party system, and the Tea Party is part of the Republican Party.
Well, there are loopy factions in the Democratic Party too. And
I keep hearing that. Who are these people? I don't know what they want. Who are the loopy Democrats?
The loopy Democrats are those that say there's no economic problem. We can preserve Social Security entirely the way it is. We can
preserve
Medicare entirely Medicaid. The way it is. Financially, over time, that is unsustainable. We saw loopy Democrats during the Bush administration who are convinced that all this was made up as an excuse to get into Iraq. You know, the 9/11 attacks and so forth. You know, there are conspiracy-minded people on both sides. It's louder on the Republican side because they don't have the presidency. So you don't have anybody kind of controlling those voices.
So going back to the fiscal responsibility mantra of the Republican Party, given the Tea Party's comments that the default would have been a good thing, can they maintain that as an image for their party?
Yeah, the challenge is that their goal is not balanced budgets or even debt reduction, which is what they really like to talk about. Their goal is really a much smaller government and much lower taxes, particularly on corporations and upper income.
What would that mean? A much smaller government.
It means you'd have to cut Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, defense, the things that people really like.
Are they willing to cut defense?
Yeah, that the Tea Party is, and that's one of the big points of tension between the McCain wing of the Republican Party and the Tea Party type.
Which is bigger, our expenses on defense or our expenses on these so-called entitlement programs? I don't consider Social Security an entitlement because I'm paying into it. It's my money. Thank you very much.
Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid put together are all much bigger than defense. But defense is bigger than the rest of domestic spending.
Defense is about 17, 18 cents out of every dollar spent by the federal government. Mm-hmm. Take everything else that you can think of, parks, funding the courts, Homeland Security, that's about 16 cents out of every dollar. So defense spending versus all of domestic.
What about interest on the debt?
Interest on the debt. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, other entitlement programs make up about two-thirds of every dollar
spent. Wouldn't
it
be better to start chipping away at all of this now than kicking it down the road five more years?
Yep.
All right. The Tea Party may be a minority within the Republican Party, but are their constituents a minority of Republican voters?
Yes, but the people that identify themselves as I am a member of the Tea Party are definitely – a small minority. However, when you go to meetings, the people who choose to go to meetings are disproportionately represented by this strong faction within. Who goes to meetings? The people that care the most. So you see a lot of county Republican parties, and I've talked to some folks in South Carolina, and they say that this is the case, that even though fewer than 10%. At last count, about 6% of South Carolinians actually said, I'm a member of the Tea Party, as opposed to people who support it. That's different. If you go to county meetings, they're the most vocal, they're the most present, so they look like within the active part of the party, like they are a majority. But that is a slight misrepresentation of what the whole party looks like. However, they're the one drafting letters to mainstream Republican representatives saying, we disagree with you for this. So your question was, are they a minority among voters? Yes, but they also have a disproportionate impact on the output of the official party.
Well, and they can use their presence at these type of meetings to elect their own kind of party offices, and that's a battle that's going on at local level and state levels within the Republican parties.
Chip in Mooresville writes, funny how our dithering democracy results in policy paralysis, debt, and declining infrastructure, while China zooms ahead with high-speed rail, record growth, surpluses, and fiscal sanity. Has money, Citizens United, and gerrymandering ruined our founding fathers' experiment?
I wouldn't take China as a great example, given that it's an authoritarian one-party state, and to do this rail and these huge infrastructure projects, they've simply looked at millions of people and said, "We're flooding your village; you just have to get out and things." But it's a point well taken that this experiment that we've been doing has led to paralysis. But we are at a 10-year stretch within a couple of hundred years of a republic, and frankly, the pendulum always swings. It just swings over a 50-year time period. It feels like we've been doing this for a long time, but the history of the Republic so far has been a lot longer, although I feel some people are afraid we may be at the end of it. Frankly, I just think we're at a pendulum swing.
Have we been here before where we can't reach an agreement on anything, where passions are so inflamed that the other party hates the other party? And how did we fix it before, if we've been here before?
Well, so the Civil War, I think we were a little angrier scared
are
each
we
other.
We actually had members of the House go over to the Senate and beat senators with canes. So, I mean, you know, let's put everything into perspective, and we don't have, you know, members of Congress bashing each other's heads in.
But I think it was you the last time we had a discussion like this, Dr. Hoffman. I think I asked, are we as a nation as deeply divided as we appear to be? And I think you or Dr. Heberlig said that no, we're not. We're most of us in the middle.
We're closely divided. We're not deeply divided. The parties are a different story. I'll let Eric take that.
Yeah, the candidates, the parties, the activists are very divided. The public is not.
We are about to have an off-year election in Charlotte and other places around the country and around the state. Here we have two people who appear to be moderate candidates for mayor from both parties, Democrat Patrick Cannon, Republican Edwin Peacock. Will what happen in Washington and the fallout from it have any impact on this off-year election here or elsewhere?
I doubt it. Both candidates are positioning themselves as pretty moderate. But I think you see the consequences of it in terms of the lack of excitement that Charlottians have about the election, that we complain about the polarization of the parties. We beg for moderate candidates, but then when we get them, we shrug our shoulders and say, well, that's not very interesting. Why should I turn out?
Yeah. Given there is such limited trust of one side by the other, have we reached a point where no one is listening? And if we – I mean, some of the points that people are trying to make on both sides are really good points, mm-hmm. but nobody seems to be wanting to hear what the other side is saying. Can we get back to an era when one side ceases to demonize the other and will actually take a moment and listen and say, okay, you have a point?
Former Governor Jim Martin had a good op-ed that about the fact that members of Congress don't stay in D.C. anymore, that they're only there Tuesday through Thursdays. If they got to know each other,
right.
That might be something.
Robert Pittenger told me that on this program. That's Dr. Michael Bitzer, Associate Professor of Politics and History, Acting Provost of Catawba College, Dr. Eric Heberlig, Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte, and Dr. Scott Hoffman, Professor of Political Science and Director of the Social and Behavioral Research Lab at Winthrop University. Nobody died here today. No one argued to the death. There are no canes in the room, but there are bow ties. Thank you all for being here. I appreciate it.
Pleasure.